I also read things like books and books without pictures.
Books without pictures. Those things exist.
I know, right?
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition, comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me as always is Brian Reese.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing really good, actually.
That's good to hear. We're coming up on the holidays.
Yes, we are recording this the week before Thanksgiving.
Yes.
So,
not the week before, days before.
Days before. Whatever. You know, let's get semantic on this. So we got Thanksgiving. My daughter will be home very soon, which is very neat. Yeah, for holidays and whatnot. But enough of that lovely banter. Today on the program, we will be discussing Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., the Steranko years. But before we get into that, there is some sad news in the world of comics that I'm sure everyone's heard about at this point. But Brian and I feel like we need to weigh in on it, or at least give our thoughts and feelings on it, and that is the death of Stan Lee. I'll let you go, Brian. What are your thoughts on Mr. Lee?
Well, like you said, we would be remiss if we didn't acknowledge and share our own personal sort of thoughts, feelings on Stan Lee and what have you. So, obviously a giant. I mean, maybe possibly the most influential comic book creator that has lived. I understand that some could argue Jack Kirby, some could argue more of the Golden Age artists in particular, but also some of the writers. You could argue more contemporary writers and all they have shaped comic history.
And I think he's way up there. You know, as you were saying, that people could argue Jack Kirby and some of the Golden Age creators. I think it became sort of fashionable to dump on Stan Lee in the 90s and maybe in the early 2000s, you know, sort of as a counter. Because let's face it, Stan Lee was very good at promoting himself.
Oh, well, yes. He was the ultimate huckster. You know, he was Smiling Stan. You know, he was, Excelsior and...
But that was all part of it. I mean, if you look, yes.
It was the shtick. It was a shtick used to sell.
This whole brand. And if you look at those early comic books, especially early 60s, that's Stan's voice. You know, even the books he wasn't writing, which I think was like one. but his voice, his persona kind of took over those early Marvel years. And that hucksterish, we call it hucksterish, but it's not in a derogatory way. It's very fun. It's very enthusiastic. And
right. I mean, he was selling snake oil. It just happened to be that the snake oil he was selling was pretty good.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone is ever going to say that Stan Lee was a great writer, at least in terms of dialogue.
I would dispute. I don't think. Okay, let me just preface this. I don't think he was, one of the greatest writers of all time. But for what he was doing at the time, he was really capturing something that was of the moment, and it was. And
sure, by saying that he wasn't a great dialogue writer is not meant to be a denigration towards him. It's just he was wearing many hats. Mm-hmm. And in the same way that I would say that this is a strange example, but the Harry Potter books.
Okay.
J.K. Rowling is not a great dialogue writer. Ooh. But she is in
there's a whole slew of people on Twitter that are going to come down hard on you right now.
Right. And that's fine. Yeah. Because this isn't about, but she is an amazing story writer. Mm-hmm. Like I like the Harry Potter books. I've read them. I have no shame in that. As a matter of fact, I'm proud of it. I enjoyed the hell out of every single one of them because they're wonderfully plotted. They are absolutely enjoyable in a fantastical world. Everything about them is a lovely thing.
Yeah, great world building.
And
it was,
and they got people. They got people to read. That has nothing to do with my feeling as to whether she, whether J.K. Rowling is writes good dialogue or not. That's a different thing. Mm-hmm. And in the same way that I approach Stan Lee, is Stan Lee was an idea man. And what wonderful, great, amazing ideas he had. And he wrote these great scripts, these great stories. The stories are great. In not every instance does the actual words on the page equal the, how should we say, the majestic idea that he had. I mentioned this a couple podcasts ago, and I'm still doing this. Is like I'm rereading the Avengers from start to finish. It's a slow go because I have my current comics to read, and I have the comics that we read for this. So it's like when I have some spare time, I'll read a few Avengers comics. But some really, really, really clunky dialogue.
Yeah, and that's that was very typical of the time.
And that's but see, that's it's typical of the time. But I'm saying that that's okay. It's okay that Stan Lee wasn't the best dialogist. What he brought to it was something so much more, and it was the story, the stories that he's telling, these big, giant, fantastical, wonderful stories. The level of imagination that that man had is sort of unparalleled amongst most other comic book creators. You might say a Grant Morrison has that sort of cosmic big story idea within him. But for the most part, you know, a lot of comic creators are more singular in their approaches. And, you know, here's Stan Lee creating, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 comics at a time. It's pretty impressive. It's very impressive. And I think that his legacy is not only earned, but in some cases still understated. Now, I think in the recent weeks, it's not understated. It is stated. But coming up to this and probably going forward, we'll go back to, well, Stan Lee was, you know, he created, only some of the most iconic comic characters of all time. You know, I think that, you know, his death is the passing of. This could get me into trouble with my fellow lit snobs, but in some ways, the passing of Stan Lee is like the passing of Mark Twain.
I'm not going to dispute that at all.
And by that, in terms of mythos and in terms of
right, no,
you know,
American folksiness,
Folksiness, and individuals who created. You know, not to get too deconstruction, I won't get deconstructionist about it, but writers or creators who defined some very singular Americanness, if that makes sense.
No, it does. I think that's a great comparison. Now, what I was thinking is, you know, you talk about his creativity, and yeah, his dialogue might be a little clunky, and there's maybe too many words on a page in those early comics.
Some of them are a little hard to get through.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. However, I do think his instincts, I mean, there is no doubt that he created these characters with someone else, with Jack Kirby, with Steve Ditko and others, but he was able to temper those other creators and guide them towards a better story and a better characterization.
Oh, yes, yes, most likely, yeah.
Because if you read Ditko after Stan Lee, I guess it's all subjective in its opinion, but he never reaches the level of Spider-Man and Doctor Strange ever again.
Right.
And Kirby, as great as Kirby is, and Fourth World is very cool, but Stan Lee's voice was necessary in those early comics. And, you know, as big as Kirby was, as big as Steve Ditko was, as great as those creators were, they would have taken those characters in much different directions. And I think Stan Lee guided them a better way.
It goes back to his vision. his vision of the universe that he was trying to create.
Right, right.
Which again, it is as a shepherd almost, you know, and you know, again, it goes back to Stannis Huckster or what have you. But he knew the world that he wanted to create in these comics, and it was such a unique world, particularly when compared to the rather poor output of DC during that decade.
But even if you look into the 70s, and Stan wasn't writing anymore, and he was editing.
He was an ambassador at that point.
Yeah, exactly. But if you look at it, the editors at that time were still mimicking his voice, mimicking his style. Roy Thomas was still doing it, and you know, because it was so ingrained.
Archie Goodwin.
It was so ingrained in Marvel's, I don't want to say DNA, but you know, it was the Marvel style. It was the Marvel method.
And the hyperbole has never gone away. You know, yes. I mean, it's when you read a Marvel's preview now, or a preview for a Marvel comic now, it's still very much like, you know, every issue of whatever comic is coming out is going to be earth-shattering. And the Marvel Universe will never be the same. And
that doesn't bother me.
From, you know, the bullpen bulletins and Stan's soapbox.
Yeah. The Marvelous Age of Marvel.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Merry Marvel Marching Society.
Exactly. You know, on a personal level, man, I grew up a Marvel kid reading these comics, and you know, Stan Lee was Marvel Comics. You saw it all day, Stan Lee Presents, and he was the narrator on all the cartoons. You know, Stan Lee was part of my life as a kid.
And the face, too. He was the face.
Yeah. And I look back on, a lot of my childhood revolves around reading and listening to Stan Lee. And I said this on Twitter the day it happened, which was, he entertained and educated and enriched my life. And, you know, I never knew the man personally, but his work was very important to me. Sorry to say.
And I think it's important, you know, what we're not ignoring some of the more negative issues in Stan Lee's life and his professional career. You know, we have to acknowledge that there are instances that we believe that Stan Lee took credit for things that maybe he shouldn't have. And that some folks did not get paid fairly for creations that they shared with Stan Lee. We're not ignoring that. And I mean, those are very real things that I think should legitimately be discussed as part of his legacy.
Now, I said that could be argued many different ways. I mean, it could, you know, I've heard others make the argument that if he hadn't stood up for himself as much as he did, he too would have been, you know, he too wouldn't have been paid as much. And so being the businessman that he was, he didn't necessarily throw people under the bus, but he did present himself as more important at times in order to get himself paid, which, sure. you know, I don't know. It's all very difficult to discuss.
Right. And, you know, I get your point. I'm not necessarily going to give him a pass, but I also think it's an argument that folks can have for years to come and have been having for many years prior. But I think that is a part of, you know, the Stan Lee story. And with every story, you have to take the good and the bad. But I think for the most part, we are here to, in this instance, to discuss the good rather than.
Oh, the absolutely. Negative. And yeah. I think overall the good outweighs anything negative. And plus, in the last few years of his life, he got to be, you know, the grand old man of comics.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of people who just
in some ways, I mean,
guy who shows up in the Marvel movies. Overall, though, that was one of the, you know, there are certain celebrities, heroes, you know, just people that you like, and their passing is, I felt very sad last week when I heard.
Yes. And, well, it's
one of those things where, you know, it's coming. He's 95 years old. It's going to happen. But at the same time, you're not prepared for something like that. It just happens. And there was just there was just a cloud that day.
Yeah. Well, and I think, again, it's like we said, it's someone who really did have a strong influence, like a direct influence, mm-hmm. on many folks' lives. You know, not just like, you know, a politician or a musician whose songs you kind of like. It's akin to a musician whose songs actually really spoke to you throughout your life. And when they pass, you feel that more strongly than, oh, X, Y, or Z actor or musician passed. I like their stuff. It's more like, oh, this musician's music really spoke to me. Or, you know, when Tom Waits dies, I'll probably have to like take off work for him. Yes. You know, it's like, you know what I mean? It's like, and I think Stan Lee was that way in his creative world. So much of our childhood and our upbringing, and even as adults.
Exactly. My adulthood is centered around Stan Lee creations. And
yeah.
And if you look at my shelf, where the movies I own, I have an entire shelf devoted to Marvel movies. And you know, Stan's in every single one of them. He's still a presence in our lives, yeah. Not just kids.
So I think ultimately, you and I both, we want to, it's a matter of, you know, we want to send out our, you know, our rest in peace to Stan Lee and acknowledge just how strong his presence was in our formative years and our years going forward.
Yep. He will be missed. Excelsior. Enough said.
Enough said.
Let's take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some trippy spies.
Yes, which is topical as well towards the passing of Stan Lee in some ways.
Yes.
So, all right, back in a few.
Director Fury, the internet is besieged with lame, lifeless podcasts.
What we need is a hard-charging, foul-mouthed band of brothers with chemistry, big brains on comics, and personality. Personality goes a long way. What we need is the Marvel Superheroes Podcast.
I'm a legal machine.
Diabolu Frank.
And I am Mr. Fix-It.
The Marvel Superheroes have arrived!
Nick, internet radio is saved!
Get this mother podcast off mother iTunes.
The Marvel Superheroes podcast can also be found on Shout Engine, Stitcher, the Internet Archive, and on Rolled Spine Podcast's blogs.
And we're back. Brian, this is your recommendation. So tell us all about it.
Okay. Well, Paul and listeners. So I recommended Nick Fury's Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., the 60s run. And I had initially recommended the entire 18-issue run. But I think I did qualify that the focus would be on the first five issues, which were the Jim Steranko issues. And that pretty much is where we're going to go from here. So let me go ahead and do the intro, and we will go from there.
Excellent.
Jim Steranko is a notorious figure in comics history. An outspoken and difficult character, Steranko revolutionized sequential art in the 60s, particularly with his work on Nick Fury, both in Strange Tales and the eponymous Fury series, however briefly. A magician, card sharp, circus performer, and swordsman, Steranko brought a wealth of real-life experience into his work in comics. With Nick Fury, Steranko pushed the boundaries of visual representation in a format that had become staid, mixing pop art, surrealism, and graphic design into pages that had traditionally been generically paneled. A sort of anti-Kirby in many ways, Steranko's use of negative space and refusal to recognize trick panel narrative gave his comics a startling pop that challenged the assumed and de rigueur conventions. Narratively, Steranko pushed boundaries, introducing sexuality and moral ambivalence into an industry that, especially due to the vile comics code, hewed close to traditional and almost Victorian standards. His battles with the censors led eventually to his rift with Marvel, leaving only a small taste of what could have been if given free rein in the Marvel sandbox. Not until Frank Miller broke all the rules with Daredevil has an artist been so singularly associated with a revolutionary interpretation of a character. As a writer, Steranko was not at his strength and would have been better served by a collaborator who would have molded his vision into a more cohesive level of storytelling. But that is neither here nor there, as history is an unkind mistress. It is the visual representation and the wealth of ideas that Steranko introduced that cement his place in the pantheon of comics creators.
Yay.
So, Paul, in some ways, I fear I may have given us a bit of a turd.
what? Okay.
With these issues, in some ways not, but I could get into that shortly. Paul, so, you know, this was my recommendation, but since you were the willing or unwilling victim of my recommendation, what did you think?
I actually like these stories. Even the non-Steranko ones, I enjoy them. I do think they're a little stilted at times. But like you said in your intro, the wealth of ideas that are going through this and the visuals, I mean, we could talk for an hour just on the visuals alone. They're
right.
Really, really quite brilliant. Yeah, I mean, we can get into the nitty-gritty of each one of the storylines a little bit later on. But overall, Steranko was doing something really fascinating. I mean, really, I use the word fascinating a lot. I should stop that. But that's what it is. It was really fascinating because he took a character, you know, that, you know, an old World War II sergeant, that was a Lee Kirby invention, and he modernized it and twisted him into a James Bond figure. And it actually is quite seamless the way he did it, you know, and he used every single trope of the spy genre at that time, mixing it with the pop art and surrealism. And it's a really unique and interesting comic for the time.
Yeah. Well, and I should clarify, I mean, I think these are fun comics.
Oh yeah.
Which is, of course, what they're supposed to be. I mean, they're nutty, and yeah, I mean, the James Bond thing is definitely there. It's a strong, you know, he is reinventing, you know, it's basically S.H.I.E.L.D. He's reinventing or setting up S.H.I.E.L.D. as, in terms of what we think of it now, as like a worldwide spy organization. And Nick Fury was the, at least under Steranko, was the suave and dashing spy figure who always gets the ladies.
Or at least one.
And, you know, it's so that element is there. It's the unfortunate thing is that, like, how short his run was. In the end, it's four issues, because issue three is it issue three or issue four? Issue four is a fill-in where they're retelling sort of the creation of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Nick Fury's place within that.
And one of the most famous covers
right.
in comics history is on that one.
Yes, and yeah. Oh, his covers. We could definitely talk about Steranko's covers.
Yeah, I mean, I actually really enjoy these. He's going balls to the wall with his spy stuff. Steranko's idea of spydom is really interesting. You can see all of his influences from war movies to James Bond films to just so much there.
Even a little bit of James Coburn's Flynn.
Yeah, absolutely. He's just everything he can see. There's even a little bit of Jack Lord from Hawaii Five-0 in there.
Oh, sure, yeah.
That kind of swagger that Nick Fury has.
When you see that, like, an issue, the first issue, too, which is, you know, has the Vegas thing going, I realize Hawaii Five-0 is not in Vegas, but it's that swinging 60s.
Yeah,
kind of, you know, you have that, the comedian Flip Mason.
Oh, it's just, yeah, it's really good. Can I ask a serious question, though?
Yes.
How many life model decoy cold opens can there be to a series?
Oh man.
It seems every single issue opens with Nick Fury's dead. Oh no, he's not. That was a life model decoy.
I believe that continues to this day.
Yeah.
With Nick Fury. I think every story featuring Nick Fury has to have like a life model decoy. And at least half of those have to start with the life model decoy being killed.
Yeah. There's even one issue where, it's the origin issue, I think. Just life model decoys are being picked off one after another.
Right,
and
yeah.
Nick Fury actually says, how many of these things do you have?
Which is actually kind of fun. I mean, I think it's unintentionally funny, and I think other writers picked up on that going forward and have had a little bit of fun.
Yes.
But yeah, even the fact that, because that's based on a Stan Lee story. So it's Stan Lee rewriting that story, I believe. And then they use like some actual dialogue from the original origin that Stan Lee had done. This is issue four. It's a fill-in because Steranko was unable to complete for whatever reason.
Well, he's doing all the writing and all the art,
which was a rarity.
Yeah,
at the time as well.
It's a rarity now,
right?
But his use of comics at this time were very wordy, as we talked about when we were talking about Stan. But his are still more wordy than they are today. But he pared down the dialogue and the description quite a bit.
Sometimes,
some of the comics feel more modern than
and that's one of the things with these comics is you say modern, and these were definitely the most modern feeling of the comics being made at that time. I mean, and that is to Steranko's credit on these, is you felt like some of the visuals, some of the stuff he used, we didn't see again until the 80s.
Oh, I know.
In the late 70s, 80s, in terms of representation and in terms of reflecting sort of the actual things that were happening at the time, as opposed to an old white guy's view of what would be happening at that time. You know, Marvel and DC had kind of a terrible sort of history with presenting counterculture.
It's true.
Stereotypically. And I think Steranko in these stories presented them, because Steranko was part of that in many ways.
And he was, I mean, going forward into the 70s, you'd see writers like, you know, Steve Gerber and Marv Wolfman and others who were really part of that era. And you'd see counterculture happening. But this was, you know, sort of the start of that, incorporating that counterculture into the comics itself. But even the storytelling,
Stanley talked Hepcat, but he wasn't a Hepcat.
No, he was not. He was an older guy when he started Marvel, which in and of itself, let's not get into Stanley.
Stay on target.
No, but if you look at that first, you know, issue number one, it opens with, what is it, 2 pages or 3 pages of no dialogue?
Right.
No description. That's unheard of.
Yeah.
For
and
a
they
comic.
Were like 6-panel grids.
Yeah.
But done, you know, and they were like slim grids where you're only seeing part of the action.
Right.
And again, a rather revolutionary visual concept.
Yeah. Really beautiful storytelling.
Yeah. And you see like the forward movement, and I had to go back and reread at it a couple times to see all of the various things that happened into it, because I didn't see like the first time around, I didn't catch the Nick Fury in a different costume rising out from the ground.
Right. Cause you get to see, you know, you kind of see only at the top of his head, then from the back.
Because your eyes are carried towards the action happening sort of above, as opposed to the action coming from below, which is really great technique.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, brilliant visual storytelling. And Steranko really was good at what he did. Unfortunately, he, like you said, he ruffled a few feathers, intentionally or otherwise.
Well, yeah. And I mean, the most famous one. So we're talking about issue one, first of all, and it's... Issue one, all of these issues are kind of genre pieces, and they're different genre pieces. Mm-hmm. So the first issue is kind of it's a spy. I would say it's more Flynn, to go back to a previous reference. The first issue is more Flynn than Bond, whereas I think issue 5 is more Bond. And I think like issue 2 is a Monsters on an Island issue. And issue 3 is a horror comic.
Yeah.
And all three are self-contained. Now they have elements that lead into future stories, but all three of them are very contained issues that are genre and are three separate genres. Basically you have spy, monster, and horror.
Yeah. Which is interesting in and of itself, because a style, a comic's style would tend to just carry over from issue to issue. Steranko was trying to, you know, do different things. Not all of it worked.
No. And there's one of my biggest complaints with the issues narratively is that take the third issue for issue 3, of course, which is that's the horror, or is intended to be a horror. It's on a Scottish moor, right? With, it's basically the Hounds of Baskerville, where you have a ghost. you know, and a ghost haunting the moor and it's killing people and whatnot. And it builds up all of this really kind of intriguing sort of ideas. And then it just peters out at the end. And it's, and the last two or three pages are, you know, it's Scooby-Doo. It's like Nick Fury has figured it out and he's unmasked, you know, the perpetrators. We don't see it happen. We just get his exposition. And of course, it turns out that it's just a bunch of Nazis, like, who have an underground, you know, ship dock with submarines.
Yeah, but that's pretty interesting, too. You get to the end and like, wait, Nazis? Where did Nazis come from?
where did that come from? And he doesn't it's one of those rare instances with Steranko where he shows or where he tells but doesn't show.
Well, I'll be honest. I think where, you know, the biggest weakness of these issues is the ending of all of them. They all just sort of peter out and, you know, oh, I've run out of pages and the end.
Which I think is what it, you know, it's like, it would have been great to be able to see him represent visually a lot of the sort of last two page expositions that he does on all of these issues.
Right. And in one case, it's just sort of a couple of panels and the,
right.
And they all lived happily ever after.
Right. And some of it doesn't, and narratively, some things just don't make sense. He skips over whole chunks of, there's numerous moments in these issues where you're like, wait, what just happened?
Yeah. If he had been given sort of given a Bendis type of 12 issues to tell a few moments kind of a thing.
Yeah.
That would have been fantastic. But this was, you have, 22 pages, tell your story and be done.
Right.
And I think it gets into that wealth of ideas thing. That you're like, there's so much going on, but I only have 22 pages to tell it in.
Yeah, and his ideas were greater than his reach in some cases. Which, again, you know, to reiterate, it's what if he had had room to expand? But he didn't. And so we have to deal with what he did.
Yeah, that's a case of what could have been. But what is here is still pretty darned amazing. I mean, I got to keep going back to the visuals.
I think that's the most important thing. And, you know, we haven't even talked about the negative space. And we haven't talked about the sex scene in issue two.
Is it a sex scene?
It is a sex scene.
It's pretty awkward, I think. No, I'm kidding, of course. But yeah, it's interesting.
So,
I love the fact that, you know, that's sexy. It's panel by panel by panel, and it's close-ups of a phone, close-up of lips, and then at the climax, it's a close-up of his gun.
Right, holstered.
Holstered.
The gun is holstered, but. For the time, well, there were several problems with that. Those panels were heavily censored. And the originally the phone here's what's interesting. And it's, so originally, and if you read more recent, collections, apparently now I was reading the original comics. I was reading the censored stuff. But originally on those panels, so for folks who may not have read it, it's a mute representation. It's him and Valentina Allegra de Fontaine, the future Madame Hydra, who is his assistant or his Mrs. Moneypenny or what have you.
It's a woman who waits around in his apartment for him to get home.
Right, it's the woman who waits around in his apartment to get home. Well, no, not at all, because she's a spy in her own right, and apparently one who is greatly accomplished. But her usage in at least these issues is more for a romantic foil, or not even a romantic foil. She's literally just there for him to have sexy time with in some cases. Although she does play an important role in issue 5 with the, in the, can I say climax of issue 5?
True.
So the sex scene, it's representational. You don't obviously see them having sex. You couldn't by any stretch of the imagination. But
they
suggestion.
Were pushing boundaries. Yeah, they were pushing boundaries here, but they couldn't push it that far.
But the suggestion is not subtle. The one thing that the censors did not let him do was the scene with the phone. Originally, in that panel, the phone was off the hook.
Oh.
And they said, you can't do that.
That's really weird.
Yeah. And there was also a scene that was cut out where they are, again, which was reinstated in later printings, like more modern printings, where he is standing and she is on her knees with her arms wrapped around his legs.
Hmm. I could see how that would be suggestive.
Right. But the fact that he got away with what is not an unsubtle page, it's a whole page worth of just, you know, this suggestion that they are to have relations, and then...
She picks up her rose and then places her rose against his lips. It's like, oh, yes. What does that mean, Miss O'Keefe?
Well, yes. Not all the let's just guess that not all the censors were that intuitive. Hence, the holstered pistol managed to survive.
I was rereading through this and saw that and just went, oh, my goodness, why don't you just have a train going through a tunnel?
Or a geyser exploding.
Yeah. Fireworks going off.
But, you know, we laugh about it now, but at the time, my God.
Yeah, no.
You know, that was... You know, and also, like, we should say, it's beautifully rendered.
Oh, yeah.
The artwork, it's Durango's great. Artwork is pretty impressive. You know, it's a lovely piece of work that is far from the clunky sort of, dare I say, like, I mean, Kirby's Kirby, but, you know, his characters tend to be very blocky. That's intentional on his part.
Yeah, that is his style.
That is not a criticism. That is his style. Which is what a lot of Marvel artists followed for a long time until, frankly, Steranko broke the rules a little bit.
Yeah, Steranko's very fluid and, mm-hmm. you know, all the images kind of flow into, you know, from one to another. And they cross over each other. There's a scene in that same, I think it's that same, or maybe it's the first issue, where it's several panels, but there's a phone, again with a phone, off the hook. So from the top, it has, you know, the receiver's on the ground at the bottom of the page. And then the cord goes all the way up to the top across all the panels.
Right.
That was really great layout.
And then nobody was doing that kind of thing. There were other artists at the time, like in more underground comics or more up and coming artists that were experimenting with that. But, no one had really just determined that panels were to be broken and not to be respected in space. You know, panels didn't exist in like negative space. I use negative space a lot in this because also his art uses negative space. You're an artist, Paul, so you know what I mean. Like when I say like there's several, he uses a lot of different panels where it's black and white, but it's the negative space creating the image.
Right, and there's a lot of stuff
that you could probably explain that better than I can.
Well, no, you just explained it perfectly. Actually, there's a lot of silhouette, and there's a lot of you make an image negative, and then it pops more, so that you get more of a I don't know how to say it, like a visceral kind of feeling when you see it.
It looks nothing like the rest of the colored panels that surround it.
Now, a good example of that is that famous cover of the black and white swirls.
Yes,
Nick Fury, holding his gun and all the psychedelic black and white behind him.
Yeah,
that's an excellent use of negative space and. Really make the image pop.
One of the greatest covers.
Yeah. Let's just say all of his covers are brilliant.
So, yeah, I mean, visually speaking, I think I'm glad you were able to like weigh in a little bit on that because I think you have a better sense of that definitely than I do. But along with the sort of visual take that that Steranko does, the issues are weird in that it feels like there's not a lot of continuity between the issues, except we do get Scorpio twice.
So who is Scorpio?
Who is Scorpio? I don't know. I have no idea who's Scorpio. I believe it is solved later on. But, you know, in subsequent issues, basically everything Steranko created or Steranko set up was just dropped.
But yeah. I mean, to be fair to other writers, there wasn't a real template for them to work with.
Right.
Scorpio is a psychedelic villain with an ankh is basically right. It. Which,
and a silly costume, because they always have silly costumes.
Yeah. I mean, but I personally think it's really cool and I think he's a fun villain, but if you want to, you know, what's his motivation? I think it's just that he hates Nick Fury.
But why?
Yeah.
And I mean, again, I believe if memory serves me correctly, I wish I could quote the entire history of comics and every issue that's every comic and every issue that's ever been written. I believe that Scorpio is resolved somewhere years later, but for our purposes here, it doesn't. You know, we're not going to go there.
We're focusing primarily on the Steranko run,
right? But there is. It does create a bit of a narrative dead space, which again, I think is, you can carry that if you're writing a longer arc, you can carry that dead space a little longer and fill it in. But because this arc is so short, it's sort of jarring, and it isn't even all that compelling a character. I mean, at least for me, did you find the character compelling?
No, it's not that he's compelling. It's just that the way he's presented on the page, as far as his look and how the visuals, again, and just, you know, some of the splash pages of him with all the different contrasting colors. And like you said, the negative space, it's really cool. I don't know what he wants or what he's intending to do other than to kill Nick Fury, but for a quick spy thriller, I guess it's not necessary.
Right, and but even still, like, I found Centurius, the big bad in issue 2, the leader of Monster Island, or the creator of Monster Island. We got his motivation.
Yeah,
and we got why he was doing what he was doing. And again, it was an interesting and very Marvel type character in that he wasn't all bad,
right,
or all good. He was something more complex.
Yeah, and I found it interesting that it's not that he hated humans, he just didn't care for us at all.
Right.
You know, we're ants on a piece of watermelon to him.
Yeah. And so he was, Centurius basically had created this island to experiment and create essentially a new master race.
Yeah.
In some ways. slightly different intent than what we normally think of when that phrase is tossed around, but it came from what was ultimately an altruistic standpoint that went, of course, as things do in comics, horrendously awry.
Indeed, I do like that this is a super secret facility that no one can find except for some film crew.
Right, if there's a film crew. And of course, just randomly SHIELD agents out on a training exercise can randomly find it at the same time that a film crew can find it.
Right. A film crew with a life-size King Kong model that can actually fight.
Right. Just happen to have.
Yeah, that's some serious FX work right there.
It is. Well, and like Jim Steranko, very ahead of its time.
And again, this gets into that whole, Steranko had a lot of ideas and was just kind of throwing as many of them on the page as he possibly could. There's an alien trying to get back to his own world and creating giant dinosaurs. And then there's a film crew who also has a giant dinosaur. And then there's SHIELD agents who happen to learn. it's like a child telling you a story. And then what happened was, and then this happened. And then the dinosaurs came, and then.
I think actually, Paul, that is a great point. That is what Steranko reads like to me. That is an excellent point. I didn't put that together until you just said it, and but that is what like these issues kind of are.
Yeah, and I actually find that very endearing. I think it's. I want to point out that later in this series, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., when Steranko leaves the book, the quality goes down quite a bit.
Yes.
You're not as enamored with them as I am. I still think they're a lot of fun to read, but the only reason I'm bringing this up is it's really night and day. You know, you get basic 60 comic.
Frank Springer is a perfectly useful artist, but he's no Steranko.
Right. Yeah. But it serves to show how good and what unique and different things Steranko was doing. When you get his replacement and say, oh, well, that's fine. And that's all I can say about the rest of the series is, yeah, that's fine. It's okay.
It's late 60s Marvel comics.
There's, you know, some questionable depictions of race and women.
Well, there's a little bit of that in Steranko's run too, which I was not sure whether to touch on or not.
Well, this is a very weird time
in comics. Because in many ways, they thought they were being progressive.
Exactly, and that's what I was going to say, is they're really trying to be very open.
And inclusive.
And inclusive, exactly. And just not quite there yet.
No, it'll take...
But they're trying. Paper effort, guys, but wow. Now, I find this, because I read a lot of comics in this time period, and I'm so torn between, I know what your intention is. I really do. But boy, this doesn't read well in 2018.
You can hear the clunk.
Yeah. You know, but this was a transitional period. The civil rights era and women's lib was just kind of in its infancy.
And they were trying to react to it. And, you know, Marvel or DC wasn't at all.
Well, no, they had the Lois Lane becomes a black woman issue.
Oh, jeez.
Boy, that was that was a high point in the civil rights movement right there.
New. Or any movement.
It was a movement, that's for sure.
Yes. But I think overall, I mean, and I think you make the perfect point there is why, you know, I think why initially I recommended this and why I went with these five issues as opposed to the sort of split issues from Strange Tales that were sort of the genesis of Steranko taking over Nick Fury is that, as fun as some of those issues are, it wasn't until he took over, you know, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., that he was given what seems to be pretty free rein.
Yeah, they allowed him to really flex his muscles art-wise and storyline. And you know what, we're going to get into this what could have been thing again, but it really is a shame that he couldn't have just been given a little bit more room.
Yeah.
Just a little bit more room and just to keep going.
Because I think it would have tightened up the narrative problems. It would have allowed us more great pages of Steranko art.
And to be fair, had he loosened up himself a little bit, he is notoriously difficult to work with.
Yes. And don't you have a...
I do.
Do we want to end this on two interesting stories about Jim Steranko?
Two interesting stories? You have one as well?
Well, you have one, and I don't have a personal story, but a little bit of trivia.
Okay. Well, my personal story is several years ago, went to the Denver Comic Con, and I took my daughter, who was, I think, 14 at the time, and one of her friends. And you have to understand, I'm the one dragging these kids to Comic Con. They were going because I wanted to go. So I'm going around, and they wanted to see the cosplay and all that kind of stuff. But Steranko... Yeah. Had a panel. It was just him. And I was very excited. This is one of my favorite comic book artists. And I was really playing it up to these girls saying, you're going to love this guy. He's such a great artist. It's going to be so interesting. He spent about 20 minutes talking about his childhood and how he used to beat people up every day and how he used to get beat up every day. Didn't talk about comics at all or very little. And then when he got to a story about how he set fire to a dog, that's when I said, okay, girls, we're out of here. Because they had tears in their eyes. They were not happy with this man. And I, you know, and it was very disappointing to me. It was like, if he had just talked about his art, if he had just talked about these panels that we're talking about, that would have been interesting. But the next generation was unimpressed with Jim Steranko.
Well, but I think that's telling in many ways. It's you can see because he, you know, and I think I even started my intro with him being kind of occasionally difficult.
Yeah.
But you can see some of that, like, you know, certainly bleed through in his work, which is actually more interesting in his work than maybe it was having a real life experience. But it does bring up sort of the that sort of informs the little piece of trivia that I had not known that I found while researching this. Like, because you were saying Steranko was talking about his life, and you know, because he's such a character outside of comics and has known and done all these various sort of pursuits throughout his life. One of them being like, he, you know, stage magic and cards and things like that. I had read while doing this, the artist Marka Vanier had said that apparently Jack Kirby used, and this is topical as well, due to a comic that's about to end or just has ended, Jack Kirby used Steranko as the basis for Mr. Miracle.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that. That's
according to Marka Vanier.
That's really interesting. It makes me want to go back and read those old Mr. Miracle comics.
Which is sort of, I think, kind of fitting in terms of, you know, the overall persona. If you think about Mr. Miracle and you think about his work on Nick Fury and other comics as well.
Yeah.
So wow. Now, whenever you read Mr. Miracle, you have to think of Jim Steranko.
I don't know if that's interesting or disturbing. Maybe a combination of both. Okay. Well, I just want to say, you were a little concerned in the beginning that you might have picked a dud as a recommendation. I disagree. I mean, these are classic comics, and maybe they're not as timely as they were when they were written, but they're still pretty amazing comics, in my opinion.
Yes.
And Steranko, for all of my I'm a little disappointed in him in my adult life still. I mean, in real life still. I can admire him as an artist and a writer and doing great comics.
Agreed.
Okay.
So I think that kind of wraps up for the most part what we have to say. We could talk for another couple hours, but I think that gives a sense of this comic. And I think we both ultimately end up recommending this.
Oh yeah. If nothing else, just, you know, you don't have to read anything. Just look at all the art. Just to flip through these pages, it's wonderful to look at.
Yes. Okay. Well, so that wraps it up for us on this, Paul. I believe it is your turn for a recommendation next. Do you have a recommendation you would like to put forth?
As a matter of fact, I do.
Excellent.
Yeah. So next time, we will be discussing the 1970s epic Aquaman, Death of a Prince, because you don't seem to want to do DC comics anymore, so I have to pick up the slack.
No, I heard there's an Aquaman movie coming out. Have you heard about this?
I have heard about this. It's almost as if I planned this.
Wow.
Yeah. So when this episode drops, it'll be about a week before the movie comes out. So you know, marketing, baby. I'm so good at it.
Yes.
What is it? Synergy? Is that the word?
Sure.
Okay. So anyway, this is Aquaman, Death of a Prince. It's written primarily by Steve Skates. Anyway, it's primarily written by Steve Skates and Paul Levitz, and drawn again primarily by Mike Grell and Jim Aparo.
That's a nice creative team.
Yeah, it is a great creative team, actually. This is the story that spanned through Adventure Comics 435 to 437, 441 to 445, and Aquaman 57 to 63. Now, you could go get all of those issues individually or simply read it in the collected edition, Aquaman, Death of a Prince.
Ooh, there's a collected edition, even better.
I know. So that's it. I don't know if you know this storyline.
I am vaguely familiar with it.
Yeah, it's one of those. It's kind of finding a good Aquaman run is difficult to do.
Peter David had a pretty good run.
Peter David had a good run. Yes, he did. But that's later. That's, you know, what, 90s. And Geoff Johns had a good run as well recently in New 52. But this one is keeping in our, because I think we're only doing 70s comics now. Or something close to it. No, but this is a you know, quintessential 1970s. And I think it is a good representation of Aquaman, I should say.
Well, excellent. I'm looking forward to reading it.
So that's next time. And as for now, thank you all for listening. And please visit our website at collectededitionpodcast.com, where you can leave comments on individual episodes. Send us a comment by email, comments@collectededitionpodcast.com, or leave us a comment on iTunes, because that does help us get found. Brian, you have anything else to say?
I do not.
Well, until next time, face front, true believers, excelsior, and keep reading comics.
Enough said.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at collectededpod, that's collected, E-D-P-O-D. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
You know, I guess one person can make a difference. Enough said.